supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Hey, I've got a story for you. This is a story of an old rabbi who prayed at the Western Wall every day for 40 years, 8 hours a day. He went there and he prayed solemnly for world peace, for an end to hunger, for people to be kind to one another every day for 40 years. And a reporter got wind of this rabbi, and he went over there to interview him. And he said, "Rabbi, you've been doing this for 40 years. He said, "Tell me what it's really like." And the rabbi said, "What it's like? It's like talking to a wall." Well, that's the difference between those of us who pray for world peace and community organizers who actually do something about it. You see, one of the reasons President-elect Obama won was his ability to bring people together, to get involved. But now that he's won, will that momentum continue, and how? And with these trying economic times, what would it take to get you from wishing or praying for peace, for a better world, to actually working for one? Well, joining me now on the telephone is William Bill Docherty. He's a professor in the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota. He's also director of the Families and Democracy Project. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And the non-Philadelphia way to pronounce my name actually is Doherty.
Doherty.
Yeah.
Okay.
I grew up in Philly, and Philadelphians tend to turn it to a Doherty, but it's actually Doherty.
Okay. I will do that. Thanks for the correction. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're talking about community activism, what it takes, what it means, what the impact is. Bill, you wrote an op-ed piece in St. Paul right after the election, advising President-elect Obama to reinvent government as a partner and not as a parent. I think that's interesting because it really does split the difference between liberal and conservative politics, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell us what that means practically, partnering with government.
Yeah, well, it's a way to think about the great tasks we have ahead of us, the great problems in healthcare and education and poverty and so many of in the environment, so many of our problems. Thinking of those not as going to be changed only by government programs, by legislators and policymakers coming up with the magical solutions, which tends to be how people on the more liberal side of the spectrum think about it, nor is it going to be solved just by minimum government and let the market handle everything, which tends to be the conservative viewpoint. But we're going to have to find a way for government, and thinking about President Obama here, to involve and engage people in becoming agents of change.
I mean,
you know, the simplest, I mean, you know, we all know if we recycle, for example, we're helping the environment. But one of the things I wrote about in that op-ed piece is that President-elect Obama has talked about how the schools cannot educate children alone. Parents have to turn the TV off and read to their kids and get involved in the school. And what I said in the article was that's a great applause line, and everyone likes it, but there's going to have to be ways in which government opens up pathways and encourages people, creates even modest incentives for parents to actually get involved collectively in educating their children.
Bill, do we have a model for this? I mean, on a grassroots level, there's plenty of organizations that do good work. As a matter of fact, towards the end of the show, we're going to hear about a wonderful organization called City Year that's very active here in Philadelphia and many other cities throughout the country. But on a national level, have we ever had that model in this country or any other country that you're aware of where government and the people it governs are actually partners?
Not very many. If you go back to the Great Depression, the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Workers' Progress Administration, the Working Artist Projects were maybe the closest we had, because those were not just, make work that people were engaged in. During the Great Depression, there were actually groups like who were rebuilding forests, replanting forests, would have morning meetings in which they would talk about the larger implications of their work. Artists were involved in making decisions about creating public art. That was the last time that I really know about that.
We're talking with Bill Dougherty. Got that right this time. We're talking about community activism. Are you involved in your community? Do you want to get involved and don't know how? What do you think it takes to get people from the sofa wishing for improvement to actually doing something about it? Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. So, Bill, tell us your vision of a partnership between government and community engagement. And let's take an example. Let's take healthcare.
Yeah. Well, one of the visions now that a lot of people have about in healthcare, one of the sort of cutting edge ideas, is something called the healthcare home or the medical home, where people would, when they're connected with a clinic, the clinic would have a multidisciplinary team. It would have mental health folks and social workers and physical therapists and nurses and physicians and a variety of folks working collaboratively in a kind of one-stop shop. As opposed to you just sort of go in, you see your doctor and
this is WHYY. Can you hear me?
Everywhere. What's missing in that plan, and by the way, one of the reasons for the plan is they're hoping they can reduce costs by coordinating care a lot better. But one of the things that's missing is any way to really engage members of that community where the clinic is in a meaningful way. So
what would that look like?
Well, that's what I'm going to say, that one of the ideas I'm floating here, and then the government connection as well as the, say, the managed healthcare, government spends a lot of money in healthcare, government could provide some modest resources and incentives for the kind of plan that I'm proposing here and we're probably going to pilot. What I'm interested in developing is a way to think about patients being invited to take out citizenship papers, if you will, in their healthcare home. And that is to have a degree of involvement which might be like being on the PTA at your school. We know that parents who are involved in the PTA, who volunteer in the classrooms, are much more likely to be also helping their kids with education and have a better experience, and they also help the school. Right now in healthcare, we have an organized delivery system, but we assume that healthcare is a service provided by professionals, paid for by government and third-party payers, delivered to passive consumers. And I think if we're going to solve our problems in healthcare, we're going to have to develop leadership pathways, just like we do in PTAs, for patients, who I would call citizen patients, to be involved in collectively generating goals and thinking about how this healthcare home, this clinic, could work with the community to better the healthcare of everyone in the community.
So this gets to the question, I guess the ultimate question when it comes to getting involved in your community. There are those that do and there are those that don't. And, you know, how do we get those who don't involved in a program like this?
What I have found in my work and in our Families and Democracy Project, and we also call it Citizen Healthcare, we don't have a big problem getting people involved because what we look for is where are what we call the pressure points. Where are people concerned about their health, about their kids, about their community? So we have a project, for instance, in the American Indian community in St. Paul, Minnesota. American Indian community is very concerned about diabetes. Many people don't have access to healthcare insurance, but they see their loved ones dying and losing limbs because of diabetes. And so along with a number of American Indians in St. Paul, we've created a communal program called the FEDS, a Family Education Diabetes Series, where people come together for communal meals. We're a physician-trained community members to do blood sugar checks on other community members and foot checks, and everyone weighs in. And we have this meal together, a program that the community decides what the program, the educational program, will be. And so it becomes a community event, and we've been able to document that people are controlling their diabetes better and losing weight. So that's an example of people come out for that, get involved in that, because it's what I call a pressure point.
And how do you find these pressure points?
Well, you listen, you talk to people. You have in community organizing, they talk about one-to-ones. You have one-to-one conversations. You have a lot of coffee with people, and you find out what's important to them. I'll give you another example in African immigrant community outside Minneapolis, where there are a lot of people from Liberia and other African countries that have had a lot of turmoil and then mass immigration. Having conversations with people in that community, listening to leaders, big concern about children's mental health, but the community doesn't like to frame it as mental health because there's a lot of stigma there. So working together over the last couple of years, we framed this as family, children's success and family well-being. So pulled together a group of community members to begin to think this through, and what they wanted to focus on was the enduring effects of war and trauma on children and families in the community. And then when we got further into that, the group said it's really what they wanted to do is to break the silence in the community about the enduring effects of war and trauma. Nobody's talking about it. They have perpetrators living next door to victims. And so what the group has decided to do is to start to use community theater. We're going to be doing this starting in the winter, community theater for the telling of stories, for music, for bringing people together to begin to break the silence about what's happened to them. Hmm. Now, what I'm saying is that that's a very different approach than the traditional healthcare approach, where you say we need a lot of mental health people to go in there, and then you say, well, they're not Africans, they don't know the culture, and everybody despairs.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones. We've got Kevin on the line. Kevin, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to first thank the station for broadcasting this program. I think community activism is just about one of the most important things we can do. And I just had two quick observations. And the first is, I think we need to see an ideological shift of sorts from the traditional American kind of individualistic culture and kind of focus on your own life and getting your own, as opposed to kind of a more communal sense of, okay, this is a collective responsibility. And I think that shift is really important for people to be willing to commit to some sort of community movement. And the second piece is really a question about what the government's active role can be in encouraging community involvement, because a lot of apathy is developed from people feeling that even if they do get involved, it's not going to really make a lasting change in the community or society. So I'm wondering what you think outside of this idea of consumer participation in the healthcare, how the government can more broadly encourage people to take part in community involvement and actually show some sort of results for that.
And make that ideological shift. Great question, Kevin.
Yeah.
Bill, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so on the first point, and they really go together, this communal sensibility, what I've learned is that it doesn't come about by exhorting or trying to shame people into caring about their neighbors. It really has to come from people seeing that their own well-being and that of their family is tied together with the well-being of others in their community. Jane Addams is credited with the famous Nobel Prize winner, was credited with saying that to be a good parent, you have to have a one foot in your home and one foot in the community, because the community is also raising your child. So it's that not just a sense of I want to do good in the world, help my neighbor, but it's my neighbor is part, my how my neighbor does is also part of how I do. And then on the government, I think the government role, we're just at the beginning of this. And I mean, my own experience is much more outside of the government realm in community organizing work than with the government. But I do know that there are innovative public leaders like the Mayor Elizabeth Kautz of Burnsville, Minnesota, who, when she took office, even before taking office, set up a series of groups of citizens in the community, listening groups. Number one, what's most important to people in their community, but also what were they willing to contribute to solving the problems in the community? And then out of that, she formed to rearrange the town government around 7 priority areas that citizens had identified, and recruited citizen advisory groups, citizen even task groups in some cases, to work on those areas with the public officials. So that's an example of somebody really thinking about it differently. And the big thing is to go beyond what do you need and what do you want to the question, what are you willing to contribute to this?
Hmm. I want to talk about definitions and what it means. I mean, we know President-elect Obama was, I guess still is, a community organizer. And, you know, Sarah Palin famously made fun of it, saying it had no responsibilities. Others have said that, you know, Christ was essentially a community organizer. So what is it? What is a community organizer, and what are the skill sets that one needs to do it effectively?
Well, there's no one answer to it, of course, but if you go back to the 1930s, there were, in the 40s, Saul Alinsky, who was an activist in the Chicago area, is credited with founding modern community organizing, although there were some radical Catholic priests even preceding him, Gino Baroni and others who even preceded him. But taking Alinsky, and that's the tradition that Barack Obama was trained in, you have a paid community organizer, and that's what Obama was, who works with, they're often faith-based groups, or often churches, other faith communities, who nominate leaders, often lay leaders, to get training in how to do these one-to-one interviews in communities to find out what's driving people, what's really bugging people, and then to decide on priority areas for action for at least a year, sometimes 2 years, and then to develop a campaign in which you try to mobilize, you know, sometimes thousands of people around getting a change, and the change might simply be a better sewage system in a neighborhood. It might be something in Minnesota, the community organizers are working around healthcare policy. And so they focus on a particular issue, and they have a campaign with outcomes they're looking for. And in some areas, they mobilize, you know, 100 faith communities, and then each leader in a faith community mobilizes, you know, dozens of other people. They often have big events where you have thousands of people show up, to which they invite political leaders who are there to hear from people and to be requested to pledge to change policies.
Well, as I listen to you, it starts with listening.
Right.
And it goes to mobilizing groups, and then it goes towards creating effective change in the larger group, which brings up a topic I want to talk about after our break, because what you've just defined sounds exactly like family therapy. And I know that's your background. I know
right.
that's what you bring to this. So we want to talk about the therapeutic value of this when we come back. We're talking with Bill Daugherty. He's a professor in the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota. He also runs the Families and Democracy Project. If you want to learn more about that or more about him, he is at drbilldaugherty.org. And if you want to join our conversation, we'd love to hear from you. We're at 888-477-9499. If you've been active in your community, if you've taken part in community service or are interested in doing so, give us a call, 888-477-9499. We'll be back in just 1 minute. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
I'm David Cooch, president of BNY Mellon Wealth Management's Mid-Atlantic region, a supporter of WHYY. For over 200 years, we've helped financially successful individuals reach their goals through the practice of wealth management.
Amy Ray has been half of the usually successful folk duo The Indigo Girls for more than 20 years.
So the question is, why is this acclaimed singer-songwriter going out on her own?
I think I'm a diehard collaborator, so it's really just my way of getting to collaborate with other folks that are in my community and people from the punk and kind of underground world.
I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kotz.
And this week on Sound Opinions, Greg and I get a visit from Indigo Girl and punk rocker Amy Ray.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY. A regular meeting of the WHYY Board of Directors is scheduled for Tuesday, December 9th at 8 a.m. at WHYY 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia. For more information, call Diane Chenault at 215-351-2063.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about our communities, our nations, what we can do to get involved, how we can get more people involved in fixing things. I'm talking with Bill Daugherty. He's a professor at the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota. And later on in the show, we're going to hear much more about City Year, a project that's involved in many cities throughout the country. We'll hear from Wanisha Foxworth and Jason Mayer, both of whom either are or were involved with the Philadelphia office of that. Bill, I want to tell you a pet peeve of mine that I know was a pet peeve of yours. I do a lot of speaking around the country, and sometimes I get frustrated because at the end of my talks, if they're good, people feel either enlightened or motivated or validated or thoughtful, but nothing happens. But nothing happens beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've had that same frustration.
Oh, yeah.
So you challenged one of the groups you spoke with, yes, when they invited you back?
Yeah. This was 10 years ago, and I was just getting started in this community work, and I was talking about the problem that of the hyper-scheduling of kids and the very competitive sports world and the younger and younger ages of kids who are running around crazy. And I had this meeting. There were 300 parents that showed up in the suburb called Wayzata, Minnesota, and it was like a like a revival meeting. People were so worked up about this issue. And then they invited me to come back the next year, and I said, "No, I only give the same talk once. But if you want to work on this and change this, I'll come back." And that was the beginning of my community organizing career. And I was learning from a group of people at the Center for Democracy and Citizenship who in turn had learned from Saul Alinsky and Martin Luther King and others, so I was mentored in an approach. And some of what I learned from that was that as a professional, as a family therapist, that if I can learn a method for working with a community, it's kind of like learning a method to work with a family, a systematic way, not just sort of plopping in and getting everybody riled up and then leaving again, that I could have some more satisfying experiences, at least for me, and perhaps make a change in the world.
Yeah, it sure is more satisfying. Let's go back to the phones. I have a feeling our next caller is right on this point. We've got Lisa on the line. Lisa?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
Hello? I'm not affiliated with a church, and for a couple of years now, I've been going out on my own and buying school supplies for children who live close to my home community. And I can't afford to do it on my own anymore. And so I don't know how to go and collect from other people and show that I'm valid and that I'm actually trying to, help the children and have people understand that I'm not just trying to take things, and sell them or anything. And so I'm not sure how to create an organization without a connection to a church or some other larger organization and be able to collect, like I said, money or supplies to give to the children in my area.
Lisa, I have a sneaking feeling you dialed the right number at the right time.
I did.
Bill, your turn. Your turn.
Well, it's great what you're doing, and I completely agree with you that, you know, even if you could afford it, doing it alone is not as good as doing it with others and trying to create a movement. What I would do is to begin by affiliating with a PTA, with a school, with a family service agency. I would consider beginning conversations. You know, go out to have coffee with somebody from an established organization, and pitch your idea and say you're willing to work on it, and start there. And then you can use the trust that they've built up in the community. And then if it takes off, then you form your own little nonprofit that, you know, with your own letterhead and so on. And at that point, you would have the endorsement of an established group in the community.
Great, that makes sense. Thank you so much for your time.
Sure.
Sure, Lisa. Thanks so much for your call. You know, Bill, this whole thing got started when I read an article you wrote in the Psychotherapy Networker, obviously a magazine that's geared to psychotherapists. You suggested in that we therapists create for ourselves a new professional role, that of citizen therapist, and that's a theme you've touched on a couple of times today. So, as an agent of change, I assume social change, I've advocated this for years. I don't think we in our office or any individual can achieve mental health unless we're also devoted to social health.
I agree. And then the challenge is, what are some systematic ways as a psychotherapist to do this, in which we're not just sort of running around trying to you know, to do good randomly. Most of us, anybody who's in a profession, you learn ways to work, and you have a discipline, you have a practice. And then outside of that discipline and that practice, a lot of us feel inept or ineffective. And so what I've done is, and with a lot of other people in the last 10 years, is to create a systematic and disciplined way for a psychotherapist or other professional who works with people to find a community to engage with, and then to learn to work on a particular issue over time in a way where you feel like you're actually accomplishing something.
I got involved in this, or got my greatest education was with a patient, over 10 years ago now, who was severely depressed, and she wasn't responding to medication. She was having terrible side effects. And she was working in a stressful job and wanted to take a leave of absence because the job was making it worse. Well, you know, as a clinician, it's dangerous for somebody with depression to not have any structured life anymore.
Yep.
So I was in a tough position. So I said to her, I'll make you a deal. I'll sign the paper and recommend it if you donate 20 hours a week to helping other beings, animals, old people, children, just living beings. And she agreed, and she did. This was an isolated person, of course, like many with depression are. She got involved in an animal workshop, animal welfare shelter, and she got involved in an old age home. Well, what happened was the depression started to lift as she got involved with good people and caring people. Her self-esteem went up. And what was amazing to me was as the depression lifted, she tried medication again and actually had fewer side effects. So this involvement actually changed the chemistry in her body.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you're not shocked to hear that.
You know, we are wired for social connections, and we are wired to do good in the world. And that's why, that's one of the great reasons to get involved, is that it's this combination of feeling better about oneself, more optimistic about the future and also making a difference in a community. Now, what I'd add to that is that I think we need to do a better job as a society, and this is where, and as professionals, and I think this is where government can help as well, in creating meaningful and satisfying volunteer work, and calling it work, because that's what people really crave. You know, as the baby boomers retire, the polls are indicating that they really want to be make a difference in the world. But if the social service agency only has you know, an hour and a half a week for you to to put stamps on envelopes, that's not the kind of involvement that I'm sure your client had, where she felt she was really making a difference. So this is where government and the professions could really do something here to open up meaningful volunteer work.
And would also diminish the risk of depression that happens with people as many of them age.
Right.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Dawn on the line. Hi, Dawn. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much. A great opportunity to speak to you about this exact topic. I actually was a paid community organizer myself. I was an executive director of a nonprofit organization that focused on community health, which included working with the school districts and the local space community, as you mentioned. And it was really a great privilege and honor, as it was satisfying and meaningful work. So to refer back to your earlier caller, Lisa, I think if she reaches out in her community, she might find an organization in her community doing this work that she can tag on to and continue to do, you know, the good work she was doing. But my main question to you is this. I'm no longer in that position anymore, and I'm looking for something satisfying and meaningful, as you mentioned. And one of the things I'd like to do is start to work with my local school district and the local government on this No Child Left Behind legislation that's going through. I know as we change administrations, the face of No Child Left Behind hopefully will change. And I would really love, as a community, to have input into that. Do you have any feedback on how to start that dialogue?
Bill?
Do you have a child in one of the schools now?
I do. I have two children, one in elementary school and one in middle school.
Yeah, so that would be your path in, I think, is the leadership pathways that are there for starters with the PTA and other groups. And then I'd try to work through your principal and your school and see if you can get into the conversation at broader and broader levels. It's really, you know, one of the problems with policy change and advocacy for policy change is that it tends to be dominated by specialists, you know, who have spent years studying those policies. And then when they invite citizens to sit around the table, it's often the CEO of some company. And so it's really a matter of using your community organizing skills to get your way into the conversation at a high enough level so that your voice could be heard.
I have a pretty lucky situation in that because of my community involvement, I have an excellent relationship with our superintendent, and I actually sit on a parent council that he has. He has certain parents from the community sit in that he actually uses as a sounding board.
Great.
And so I have an opportunity. I'm wondering from here, where do I take it? How do I already use this leverage or this kind of position I have to get involved, to make good change? And because I do have the ability to reach a lot of people in the community to kind of organize them, and I think there's a lot of desire to do that here.
Sounds like you want Bill to be real concrete here.
Well, and you know more about this than I do, so I'll just say in general, really developing your expertise on this legislation and on what the alternatives are. As I said, it's highly dominated by the educational policy wonks, and so I would do everything I could to get very familiar with the research on this and what the policy options are. And then I would ask the superintendent, how can I help? You know, if you and the superintendent are on the same wavelength, how can you help your superintendent? It's talking to people in Congress. How can you help take it to that next step? Because this is going to be decided in Washington. And so be making the leap from the local level to that national level by being sponsored by people like your superintendent. Just a thought.
Okay, Dawn. Thanks so much for your call.
Thanks.
Well, Bill, unfortunately, we're going to have to say goodbye to you. We're going to be talking about City Year in the next segment of our show.
Sounds good.
Thanks so much for
joining
us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Bill Daugherty is a professor at the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota. He's also director of the Families and Democracy Project. Look him up on his website, drbilldougherty.org. When we come back, we're going to be talking about City Year with Juanita Foxworth. She's co-director of City Year in Philadelphia, and she's been with the organization for 12 years. We'll also talk with Jason Mayer. He's an attorney now in Northern Virginia and a former City Year Corps member. Well, you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY, right here in Philadelphia.
And your efforts to stay healthy. ChristianaCare's Helen F. Graham Cancer Center is one of only 14 in the country selected by the National Cancer Institute as a community cancer center program. Patients are offered a team of medical experts backed up by the latest research trials, technology, and a personal care coordinator who guides them every step of the way. More information online at christianacare.org/cancer.
Next time on Day to Day, Africans praise President Bush for his aid to their continent.
This is one of his best legacies.
Africans are also celebrating the election of Barack Obama.
It raises enormous expectations that President Obama will do even more.
Not an easy feat in the middle of a financial crisis.
Building further on that is going to be a challenge.
America's future plans for Africa next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the community, getting involved in the community. What can, should, will be done to make our world a better place? Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're talking with Juanita Foxworth, who's co-director of City Year in Philadelphia. She's worked with the organization for 12 years. Juanita, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And we've also got on the phone Jason Mayer. He's an attorney in Northern Virginia and a former City Corps member, volunteer. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Juanita, let's start with you. I'm going to start with a really tough question.
Okay.
So brace yourself. What is City Year?
Oh, that's a difficult question. City Year is a national nonprofit. It's an AmeriCorps program for young people, 17 to 24, to dedicate 10 months or a school year, a semester of their lives to a particular community. Normally, we work in schools doing tutoring and mentoring. They work on diverse teams. They go out and they run after school programs. And in return for their service to their communities, they receive $5,000 in scholarship money to go on for higher education or to pay back student loans if they've already gone to college.
A full year. I mean, that's one heck of a commitment. How do you get people to donate a year? Well, not donate, but to give a year of their lives? Well, let me talk to you. Jason?
I'm here.
Yeah, so what got you involved in this?
You know, there was a couple reasons. For me, I'd actually gone to a City Year, what they call a roundtable discussion, when I was in college. I got to meet a few of the core members and some of the staff members and find out what they'd been doing and learn about their different service projects. And it was actually a very inspirational experience for me. And I thought that maybe if I had the chance to take a year off from the sort of college grad school track, that it'd be a good way to spend a year. I really wanted to give back to the Philadelphia community, having gone to Penn and feeling like I had a great experience living in downtown Philadelphia. And, you know, City Year was, it sort of gave me everything I wanted. It was an opportunity to actually serve a community that I knew well, to give back, to do something good, and to work with kids.
Well, how did you get to the meeting in the first place?
My folks actually family friends with one of the board members of City Year Philadelphia, and they suggested that I come down and check it out and meet some folks. And, you know, they always thought it'd be a good fit for me, and I'm really so thankful that they did. It changed my life.
What did it take for you to, I mean, it's a year. I mean,
yeah.
It's, you know, here you are, you know, you're at Penn, you're thinking about law school. I mean, you're on a fast track guy. Most people on the fast track don't stop for a year.
Well, you know, I sort of think of it as a symbiosis, like the symbiosis of service, you know, that it's not only do you get a chance to improve the lives of some children, and I worked with 90 crazy, crazy eighth graders in North Philadelphia, but also the opportunity to improve myself and to grow a little bit, you know, sort of breaking outside of my comfort zone and doing something that I thought was good for the world. And it was very challenging. It's, you know, with people that I never met before, and the partner I had in my school was a 17-year-old African-American Muslim woman, and you know, the power of the two of us walking into our classroom the first day wearing the same uniform with the same mission and the same goals, it's it's very powerful, and our children really responded to that image, I think.
Juanisha, the picture Jason's painting about himself is that he comes from a family that's focused on the community, that cares about the larger world. Is this typical of the people you get to volunteer, or no?
Yeah, it's typical in the young people. That's what we look for, young people that want to give back to their communities, whether they're coming from high school and they want to take a year off before they go to college, whether they're coming out of their college career. We're looking for young people that want to give back. Now, not all the time do they have the opportunity in their younger years to give back in this type of way. This is full time. They want to be able to say to their communities that they were able to give back. I am one of those people. I took off a year from college, and I thought I was going to law school, and I did a year of service wearing the red jacket in City Year. And it was from my mother and my father telling me that, you know, even though you might not have, somebody else is all better, worse off than you are. So you always have to give back. And it was just such a rewarding experience for me to take that year and to give back to young people in my own city.
What did you do?
I worked in an elementary school in North Philadelphia with kindergartners, as a matter of fact, during my year of service. And the young people that I met, or those young students that I met in kindergarten, who in and of themselves didn't have already the foundation needed to be great citizens. They were all 5 and 6 year olds, but they still weren't on the path to greatness because they didn't have all the tools that they needed to even start off their educational career in the right path.
What did you do?
Well, I took a couple of them who obviously didn't come with the great skills that they needed. One young man I remember so vividly, his name was Christopher, and he could not recognize the letters. He couldn't spell his name. He had no idea where he lived. Some things that we take for granted that we think every kindergartner should have when they come in, but he didn't have those skills. So I worked all year specifically with Christopher and other students like that, trying to get him, you know, at least up to the level of a kindergartner. And I will tell you that he wasn't all the way up to the kindergarten level when I ended my year, but he did have some great successes.
He also had a great experience by spending a year with somebody who cared about him and his welfare.
Definitely. You know, in our classrooms, they're overcrowding, and they're teachers that are trying to meet students at every level since there are so many students in the classroom. And to have another adult, another young person close in age, someone that the students can look up to, is just a rewarding experience.
I should say, I just read an article where they studied kids over a lifespan from age 3 to 27. These are kids who are inner city kids, who, like the kids you described in kindergarten. And those who had intervention early on, just exactly what you're describing, those who had intervention, when they looked at them when they were 24, 25 years old, had better physical health, better sexual health, better social health, and better economic health, just from intervention early on. Jason, give us a sense of what you did with the eighth graders. What was the work?
We put together what we called a service learning project, and actually I'll give a plug here to the president-elect. One of the things they've outlined in their plan for national service is the requirement that all middle and high school students do 50 hours of community service, and they're actually going to outline some national guidelines for service learning, which I think is great. I had 90 students, 3 classes of 30 eighth graders each, and the project we did was based around the idea of stereotyping, trying to get our students to understand that they, as inner-city youth, are stereotyped every day as not caring about school, as not caring about their work, as being lackluster. And, of course, in most cases, this has nothing to do with their school attitude. It's the environment around them that puts them in this position. And so trying to get them to understand the concept of stereotypes and then to sort of to counteract that, to combat that. We had our eighth graders going out to elementary schools and actually teaching them how to read, doing some tutoring and mentoring of their own. So their service, the way that they learned was actually by doing service on their own. So we combined their service efforts with actually all of their core academic curricula. So the whole project year was based around the idea of stereotyping. So, for example, in their history classes, they were all doing research on groups in the past that were stereotyped.
Is part of the goal, and I'll turn to you, Juanisha, is part of the goal to get kids who are also interested in community service as they age, kids who will hopefully join, you know, City Year and other organizations like it?
Oh, definitely. We believe that our community needs people to give back to it. And so you're never too young to be able to give back. And that's some of the the messaging that we like to give to the students while we're working with them. We also run Saturday and weekend programs for middle school and high school students who have the opportunity to come in to work kind of on a mini city year experience. And they come in, they work on teams, they learn about a particular issue, and then they go out and they serve that weekend on that particular issue. It's able to infuse that service ethic in them.
So you said you're never too young to give something back. You're also never too old. City Year doesn't have a program for older people.
Not at this moment. We don't. Our co-founders 20 years ago believed that young people were the ones kind of taken for granted, that oftentimes if you see service, it was happening with older adults. And so they wanted to give young people an opportunity to have a venue to give back and to have a positive light. But we're looking into how we can definitely tap into the baby boomers and to the older citizens.
Look hard, because I'm one of them. Let's go to the phones. We've got Mary on the line. Mary, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you, Dr. Dan. I have a bit of a croaky voice. I'm sorry, I've got a little cold, but I'm just fascinated with this program because I started my community activism when I was about 15 in Northwest Philadelphia as a schoolgirl, and even though I lived in other places for a number of years, I came back to Philadelphia about 10 years ago. But everywhere I was, I tried to get involved in the community and getting doing some organizing in some places and working with school kids and others. And one of the things that I think it's important for volunteers to understand is that a lot of times you have to go toe-to-toe with people in your community who are on the board of whatever organization for their own financial interests. And it's very important for citizens not to give up and get discouraged, but to, as I say, stand toe-to-toe with those real estate people, developers, or whoever that want to change the community in a way that maybe the populace doesn't want to see it changed.
Well, Mary, my grandfather, who grew up in Russia under the Tsar, told me that if you make the right enemies, you know you're living a good life.
Well, I'm 75 now, and I'm glad to hear that.
So I guess that's any community organizer ought to know that.
And I'm delighted to hear about City Year. I had heard about it briefly, but I didn't know all the ins and outs. If they ever get around to using older folks, why, sign me up.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna be nagging Wanisha some more after this show. So thanks so much for your call. Thank you, Mary. Jason, I'm curious about that year you've spent. In hindsight, how long ago was that?
I did the Corps in Philly in 2001, 2002.
Okay, five, 6 years ago.
Yep.
Tell me what impact that had on your life when you look back.
Well, it was tremendous. I did City Year at obviously the same time the 9/11 struck. I had always thought that I wanted to build a career somehow around public service or something in the public interest area, but my intention had been to be a lawyer and sort of who knows where you go from there. But, you know, City Year, learning about service and the power of diversity and being able to break down social barriers and all that kind of stuff, and then combining that with 9/11, it drove me straight down to Washington, D.C., and I really wanted to get involved in the national security area for the country and sort of combining national service with, you know, the way I felt about what had happened on 9/11 and all that stuff. So it really changed the course of my life, and it drove me in a very specific career direction.
How so?
Well, as I've gotten down here, as I've gotten involved in the community in Washington, not only am I sort of working in the counterterrorism community, but I'm also still heavily involved with City Year in D.C. I'm on the alumni board down here and continuing to stay involved in the work that they do. You know, it's service is not something you do for a year; it's something you do for your life. It's a decision that you make. It's a way that you change the mindset of your world and the way that you approach your world. And I feel very thankful that I've had the opportunity both to do City Year and to continue my relationship with the organization.
Yeah, I'll bet you sleep well at night, too.
Sometimes.
Don't be that honest, for God's sakes. I'm trying to make a point.
Well, I appreciate that.
My goodness. Wanisha, you opened City Year in Louisiana right after Hurricane Katrina. What was that like? How did you get people mobilized when they were in such dire straits?
Well, I thought my year in Philadelphia was going to be the most rewarding experience of my life. And then the hurricanes hit, and the organization hadn't had a didn't have a program in Louisiana, but we wanted to do something as so many Americans wanted to do. And so 2 weeks after the Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, I was on a plane on my way to Baton Rouge. And when I got there and what I saw was just so unreal. And the charge from the organization was to find out what we could do in a short amount of time. But what I realized when I landed is that it wasn't going to take a short amount of time to do the work that needed to happen in Louisiana. It needed to be a long period of time. And so I mobilized a group of alumni to come to the Louisiana area and to work alongside the young people right there in that community to give back to their community and to rebuild Louisiana.
How so? Be concrete.
Well, it was more like a call to action. We sent out emails and phone trees to all of our alums across the country. We were looking for 50 young people that could, in a matter of a month, pick up their lives and move to the Baton Rouge area to give back to their community. And I'll tell you, the response was overwhelming. We wanted to not only to use our alums, people that had been through the program so they understood City Air, but use the young people right there in that community themselves. They wanted to give back. And so there we just beat the pavement. But what I saw in the trailer homes and the trailer parks is that there weren't as many young people as we thought could take out 6 months, because we did this program for 6 months of their lives. They had to pretty much rebuild their lives. But we had 25 great young people from the Louisiana area and then 25 great alums. And they came in January of the next year and to work on City Air, what we call Louisiana. And they worked in the Baton Rouge community with the hurricane evacuees as well as in the New Orleans area.
So what impact did that have on you?
It changed my outlook. I have been with City Air for 12 years now, and the first kind of 8 years of my career was here in Philadelphia and giving back to my own city. But I realized that so much needs to be done around our country, and our country is in dire need and dire straits. And to have the opportunity to go to another state was just so important and opened my eyes tremendously.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming out here, of course, but for the work you do. And Jason, for the work you do, I want to thank you. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. It was an honor to be on the program.
Well, thank you so much.
Wanesha, thank you. Wanesha Foxworth is co-director of City Year in Philadelphia, and she's been with the organization for 12 years. Jason Mayer's an attorney in Northern Virginia and former City Year Corps member. Earlier on, we heard from William Bill Doherty. He is a professor in the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota. His website is drbilldoherty.com. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll be talking about resilience, people of all sorts of life difficulties. What do they all have in common, those who have survived and even thrived? Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org, or you can reach me directly at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer for radio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Voices in the Family is co-produced by Gita Simons and Elisa Walters. I'm